Hello and welcome to Willosophy with Will Anderson. My name is Podcast Mike, and this week's guest on the podcast is Alex Lee. Alex Lee is a TV presenter, writer, actor, and comedian. You may know her from her work on The Feed on SBS, but she has also done a bunch of work across a lot of the Chasers team. She has done a bunch of comedy shows and is going to be hosting a brand new quiz show on the ABC called Win the Week, which airs on Wednesday the 23rd of June at 8 p.m, so you can catch it there on the ABC. Win the Week also features Craig Rucastle, who has previously been a guest on Willosophy, so if you'd like to check out another episode after listening to this one, definitely scroll up in your feed and check out Craig's episode. Will is doing a few shows coming up of his What You're Talking About, Will, completely improvised stand-up shows. There is one on Saturday the 3rd of July at the Enmore Theatre in Sydney, and the 4th of July at the Brisbane Powerhouse. As well as that, you can catch him in the Gold Coast on July 24th, 7:30 p.m. at Sound Lounge on the Gold Coast. Get your tickets, willanderson.com. We also have a Patreon for Willosophy, patreon.com/willosophy. You can contribute as little as $1 a month to help keep the lights on here at Tofop Productions, where we make all of these shows. We also have a bunch of other shows, including Tofop, Fofop, and Two Guys, One Cup, and AFL Adjacent Podcast. So if you want to find more of the content we make here, go to tofop.com. You can see it all there. This is a really great episode, so I'll pass it over to Will and Alex Lee for this episode of Willosophy. Enjoy.
Hello and welcome to Willosophy with Will Anderson. I'm Will Anderson from the title of the podcast, and this is how the show starts. I ask my guests who they are. So who are you?
I am Alex Lee.
Hello, Alex Lee. It's nice to have you on the show. I appreciate that you rescheduled from this morning when we were meant to be doing this. And you've already done a great disclaimer at the start for me, but I'm going to share it with the audience, which is that you are on ABC Wi-Fi, so it could be a little sketchy, and I totally understand what you mean.
Yeah, hanging by a thread.
Well, let's start at the ABC, because you are at the ABC at the moment because you're about to host a brand new show on the ABC called Win the Week, which will be Wednesday nights at 8 o'clock. Either in the week this is coming out or the week after this is coming out. We're going to get this episode up in time before it debuts. You've had a career already. You've done, great stuff with The Feed, and you were involved in Rove Show. And so this is not your first foray into the world of television, but this is you hosting a pretty prime time show on Wednesday night on the ABC, which is traditionally, their sort of prime time entertainment night on the ABC. I was thinking about that quite a lot this week, because I remember back when it's 20 year anniversary in August of when we did the first episode of The Glass House. And I figured in a way that we were in kind of similar-ish positions. We've both done some other stuff, but this is the first time that you're sitting in the hot seat, and there are some responsibilities that come with hosting a show. So if you don't mind, talk to me about how your life is at the moment and how you're feeling about that.
Yeah, sure. Well, it is definitely like a big step up. Like, I think I was talking to an ABC executive a couple of weeks ago, and he called it the Broadway slot, which is terrifying. I'm sort of used to doing things that sort of fly under the radar a bit more. It's really exciting. We've done two test shows, so just going out in front of a live audience, but not obviously broadcasting. I guess I try not to think about the responsibility of it too much, or I'll sweat through all my clothes. it's been a lot of fun, and it's just that thing where you're like, well, we like the show, we think it's great, and just hope people don't hate me and we'll be all good.
I didn't mean to burden it with some great responsibility. You're hosting an entertainment TV panel show. Let's not take ourselves too seriously.
True.
But
yeah.
in the ridiculous way we've chosen to make our living, it's a serious thing. And so I just really wanted your sense of where you're at. Are you excited? Are you nervous? Is it a combination of those things? Do you have an attitude to not think about it too much and just think about the show? What's your approach in general to it?
I think I'm just excited about it, really. Like, I think that the concept of the show is really good. I think it's one of those things. I have high hopes for it. You know, I want it to, you know, have more than... We've only got 8 episodes this season, so I'd love for it to have another season and, you know, find its feet. And I'd love for it to be, you know, a platform for other comedians and, you know, other people who are trying to get a foot in this industry, which is, you know, increasingly becoming more difficult. I think most of all, I just want people to see it, and I hope that all the laughs and stuff that we're having on set is going to be translated, and it'll be something that, you know, people look forward to and they feel sort of welcomed into it.
Do you have a hosting philosophy? Like, is there something in a way, have you defined what your role is in the show, what you think you're going to bring to the table?
Or is that
still a work in progress?
Oh, it's definitely a work in progress. I will say, like, watching back the first test we did, I realised that I was saying "well done" a lot when people got answers right, and I think that might be from having a 2-year-old and, like, you know, constantly encouraging. And I said, "Oh, I'm going to have to stop doing that. Like, I can't be telling everyone they're doing a great job as we go." And then people said, "Oh, it's kind of nice." So
maybe that'll be it. You're told that you're doing a good job.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, if everyone could get full
marks,
that would be great.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a new culture. Let's just have some positive news for a while. Yeah. Everyone's a winner. That's the twist at the end of the show, M. Night Shyamalan style. Okay, so I think there probably is a similarity to hosting a TV panel show to, like, looking after a 2-year-old, because you are going to have to do a lot of herding cats. Like, is that something that you're comfortable with?
Yeah, I love it. Like, I would much prefer it to be chaos, and it is chaos. Like, there's 6 people, 3 of them are people you know from the media, and the other 3 are regular Aussies who we've brought in to compete, and, you know, they've got huge personalities as well, and, you know, so it's dealing with that combination of, you know, people who know what the game is a bit, and, you know, they're trying to get their jokes in and their screen time in, and then people who've got no idea what's happening but they're along for the ride. And I would much prefer to be having to rein people in than, you know, having to prod them to chat and have fun. So I guess it is just about making sure that they feel comfortable and safe, as well as, I think that has to be the grounding of it for a show that is sort of about, you know, betraying your celebrity partner, and it's about, you know, taking a few little jabs at people, and it's sort of grounding the celebrity guests we have in that way, but I think the basis of that has to be an environment where everyone feels comfortable and supported.
And so, is TV panel, game shows, these style of shows, is it something that was part of, you know, your growing up? Did you watch shows like this, or is this like a new experience for you?
It's a new experience, really.
So what makes you say yes to this then? Like, what is it about? Because, like, I can understand if you grew up on, like, you know, if you suddenly said, no, my favorite, like, TV shows are, like, yeah, QI and Have You Been Paying Attention? And, like, I've always wanted to be involved in a show like this. But I like your answer. I find it more interesting because now I'm curious about how you find yourself, you know, in this role doing this job.
Yeah. It's a good question. The kind of shows I grew up watching, yeah, we weren't really into it that much. I watched Sale of the Century and things like that. I guess that's more where it is as opposed to, like, the sort of panel shows. And, the boring answer is that they tried out a few people and I thought, oh yeah, I mean, it didn't even occur to me.
I get why they would choose you. I'm 100% across that. You don't need to make the case for why they would choose you. You're a You're a great choice. That's fine. I'm more interested in why you choose it. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's... I guess I really like the idea of being able to helm something that people can just have a good time in front of, you know, regardless of what that is. I really like the fact that this show does have real stakes and, you know, no, we're not briefing anyone beforehand. No one gets the questions, like even Craig, who is the EP of the show and is also one of the people competing every week. He's locked away, far away from us writing all the questions in a separate office.
Here's what I would say, by the way. What a stroke of genius as an executive producer of TV show. Like having done that role, the fact that he's come up with something where he just, by law of the show, does not have to be involved in the majority of the meetings is a stroke of genius.
It's good, isn't it? He does suffer by having to do the overnight edit, so that's his payback. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Okay,
so pretty good hack. What was it that you brought you to... Well, how do you describe what it is you do? If somebody says, what's your job, what do you say?
I would usually say, I'm a comedy writer and presenter. I do write everything that I've ever done, and that's important to me. And that's part of the process that I really like. It's a funny thing because you just sort of, it's just like, well, I'll do whatever job anyone gives me, really. I act as well. Or, I mean, I auditioned for acting roles. It's not quite the same.
I mean, you act a lot, obviously. Yeah. But comedy sketch work, which somehow you just pretending isn't acting when clearly heaps of acting.
it's
like different
acting.
Characters, like, every day.
Yeah,
and, like, you know... Like some like actors, they're like, yeah, he's a really good actor. He's played the same person for like 7 years. It's fine, mate. Like after a while, you know that person more than you know.
Yeah,
being
just
a sketch
on
actor.
An old suit. Yeah,
yeah, that's a whole bunch of different skills that you bring to the table all the time. So I imagine that you are, but comedy is the general area where you work. So what brought you to comedy? You know, like what were your inspirations? Why was it the comedy that particularly attracted? Because you can be a writer and an actor in all sorts of
fields.
That's true. But you've clearly gravitated towards comedy.
Yeah. I think there was definitely a moment in high school when I realized it was important to be funny to survive in a way. I was like, oh, like kind of being very sort of very quiet and shy, but also a bit of a nerd. I was like, oh, I don't look like those popular girls. So I'm going to have to do something else, like very calculated, possibly a psychopath. And I thought, oh, okay, it's important to be funny. And I loved reading like funny books and things like that. And, you know, watching shows like Full Frontal was a big part of, you know, my growing up and what I did with my family. But I think it's performing comedy in front of a live audience and just having that feedback and being able to produce, you know, such a big physical reaction from people. Like, it's just so addictive. Like, once you do it, you really can't even imagine doing anything else, I think.
How did you cope with the time in the world where you couldn't do it?
I do this Dungeons and Dragons live comedy podcast, which I've been doing for like 6 years now with some of my best friends. And we normally do that as a live show, and we had to shift to doing it over Zoom. And that was really hard. Like, you sort of forget how much of a role the live audience plays in that. And, you know, it was a big adjustment having to just rely on each other. But, you know, at least we had that. Like, at least I could, you know, still come together with my mates and, you know, have a couple of hours where we made each other laugh at least. And, I guess I was still lucky to have that, and I was still lucky to be able to work at the feed because it falls under the umbrella of news and current affairs. So we were, through a magical loophole, we were still able to make comedy through the pandemic. So I do consider myself very lucky. There was a time when we were running around Bondi in the middle of lockdown filming a sketch, and I was just like, what are we doing? Like, how are we allowed to do this?
Did you ever question, like, what comedy's role is in the middle of a time like that? Because Bo Burnham, his new special Inside, which I highly recommend people check out, but at the heart of it is this sort of conflict between whether comedy's really necessary in terrible times, or is comedy really necessary in terrible times? And, you know, where do you fit amongst that? In a time of essential workers, you know, frontline workers being out there, doctors, nurses, teachers, you know, people at supermarkets, you're also running around with a camera making comedy sketches. Did you consider yourself to be essential doing something that was essential?
To be honest, no.
I'm here from the compliment. I've got some questions. Yeah. No.
I do think, you know, from my personal experience, that I really did turn to comedy and lighthearted shows. Like, I just didn't have the capacity to engage with, you know, anything particularly emotionally challenging. I do think that there's a power in comedy, you know, which at the centre of it, it serves, like, a joke serves to make people feel less alone. There's an observation and someone goes, oh, I feel like that too, and that's why I'm laughing. Or, I've never thought of it that way, but yes, oh my God, I totally relate to that. And so I think there's something, you know, just in the nature of what comedy is, that there is, you know, some sense of community, or just feeling like, oh, that's a feeling, or that's something that I've thought about, or I've never been able to articulate in that way, but laughter can sometimes be just relief that someone else has had the terrible dark thoughts that you've had.
I think when I first started doing comedy, if, like, a joke wasn't landing for 50% of the audience or whatever, eventually it'd get replaced with a joke that was, like, you know, appealing more broadly. But then after a while, you just like to keep a couple in there that are really just for you and the one or two other people who totally get what you're talking about. Because you feel like it's almost more important.
That's right.
Because clearly, if this is not the majority opinion, if it is just the three of us, it's even more important that you heard tonight that you are not alone.
And it's a certain type of laugh, isn't it? You know, it's, you know, the uplifting audience laugh is one thing, but just one person at the back cracking up. Yeah, I was such a baby. That just reminded me of when we were doing a Dragon Prince show the other night. I did a joke about a fairly obscure film. It was a reference to Jiro Dreams of Sushi. And it didn't get a very big laugh in the crowd. And I said, that was a good joke, and if you liked it, tweet at me. Like, what a little brat. And people did.
Oh, no. I do that all the time. I mean, when I'm doing my improv shows, like, yeah. I mean, sometimes it's just a device for fun, but sometimes I literally have riffed something because my brain is trying so hard to find that next connection. Yeah. I've made a leap that even I am not really responsible for. It's just like the way your brain is firing. Totally. And it leaps, it takes two leaps ahead, and you suddenly say something that actually is genius. It's not the audience's fault they didn't get it, because you jumped a connection. They just suddenly see you go from one thing to this other thing. But you're right. You saw it in your head. And then the idea of then when I go back and explain that to them and kind of break it down and go, no, if you had this bit of knowledge, you would have realized that what I was
here
saying
are the
here,
missing steps of the ladder. I'm sorry I didn't give them to you.
Some of my favorite bits. So, okay, have you considered the idea? Again, I don't want to be like some fill your head with things to worry about. Have you considered the idea that you might have to do the show without a studio audience?
Yes. I mean, I don't even like the fact they have to wear masks, you know. You just feel like that's just another layer in front of them and you, you know, not being able to see their smiles. I think it would have a very different feel to it. You know, I think it would still be doable. You just have to, I guess, be more... Everyone in the room would have to be more supportive of each other and, to make sure it didn't feel like we were all in a vacuum.
I mean, is it something that you think about? Like, is it something that's on your mind, or are you the sort of person that's just like, well, me thinking about it, it's not going to affect it one way or the other. If it happens to be the case, we'll worry about it when we get to it.
Yeah, I'm pretty good at that, actually. Like, you know, I can say, well, I'm worrying about something. Is worrying about it going to change anything? No, it's out of my control. Okay. Yeah, so I'm pretty good at sort of segmenting those thoughts and putting them away if they're not useful.
Do you feel like, and this is me asking myself a question more than it's me asking you a question, if it feels too personal, but compartmentalizing things, right? The capacity to be able to just lock it up and put it away can be a really good life skill, but it can also sometimes mean that you just put stuff away that you probably should have like got back down off the shelf and opened up and messed around in a little bit more. Mm. How are you at that? Are you good at sort of also knowing like, when you're at, you know, compartmentalizing things in an unhealthy way?
I don't know. Gosh.
Sorry, this podcast dives in a bit deep sometimes.
It's a great question. I was just trying to think of an example. Yeah, like sometimes I think, oh, that's, I'm sort of dealing with this okay. And I'm like, sometimes I go, maybe I'm just too stupid. Like, maybe I should be worried about this more, but I just don't have the mental capacity. I'm a very lucky idiot.
Is there any big ticket items that you do worry about? Like, are things like climate change or, you know, the state of the world, things that occupy a lot of your thoughts?
Yeah, it does. And I feel like, you know, one good thing about the work I do on the feed, where I do, you know, I can sort of work through some of them, those thoughts in sketches or in the monologue that I do in studio. That can help you work through some of those feelings or feel like you're putting together all those sort of swirling worries and things like that into something that's cogent and coherent. I think that can help. There are a lot of things, you know, especially having a child, like there are things you worry about with the future and, you know, what the world's going to be like. And I guess you just have to, think about what you can do now to help. And I think I probably got a few thoughts just lodged away back there in the mind shelves that are I'm too busy
move slightly sideways, but related to what you were talking about, which was the particularly the sketch work you do on the feed, because I am a person who would traditionally describe myself as just, I'm not anti-sketch comedy, but it's just never been the sort of comedy that I gravitated towards.
Mm.
But I think the work that you guys are doing at the feed and have done, like not just you guys, but like, you know, it has been done consistently at the feed now for a very long time, it's just so consistently good. Like, I find that it's so often making a very good point in a very, very funny way, but just the acting and the timing and the quality of the writing, like it's really, I mean, I think I became like, I think what had happened was I felt like it wasn't for me, you know, like I felt like I was a bit old and it's like, it's you know, the SBS young people, you know, making funny stuff for young people and it's not really for me. And then at some stage I started paying attention to it and then just went on a deep dive, watched a whole bunch of old stuff. Like, it's a really incredibly creative environment. Can you tell me a little bit about what's going on there, what the philosophy there is, like, you know, why you think, if you do think, you know, what I've just said, I mean, it's harder for you to say it than it is for me to say it, but like, what is it? It feels like a very creative time there.
That's amazing to hear. I think a lot of it is just having done the time. Like, before last year, the feed was a daily show, and so you were forced to get a sketch up every single, like, you know, if you'd work 3 days a week, you'd do a sketch every day that you were working, and it really forces you to get out of your head and get over yourself a bit and just go, well, I've got to get something done, and, you know, I'm going to use the resources that I have, and, you know, there's no time in the day for self-doubt, so you've just got to get something out. And, you know, I think the sketches that we made on a daily turnaround were not as good as the sketches that we now get to make, you know, with a few days up our sleeve. But I think that grounding is really important as a writer, just to really clarify your idea. I think the other good thing, which is quite unusual about the show, is it's not a comedy show. It's a news and current affairs program that happens to have some comedy at the end of it. And I think a strength of it is having to justify your silly little ideas to a very busy person who's trying to put together a different kind of show is very useful. And you have to sort of, you know, I think it helps you not be up your own ass and being like, oh, you know, this is just some comedy idea for sort of the kind of thing that comedians will only appreciate. Like, you've got to go, well, no, this is going out to an audience of people who don't consume the type of stuff you do every day. And I think that helps definitely, just to make sure that your ideas are clear. And yeah, one thing that occurred to me, especially being forced last year to pretty much make, I don't know, 30 or more sketches just about COVID, because that's all that was happening in the year, and trying to find an angle on that, it's really about going, you know, not just looking at it, something that's happened in the news and saying to yourself, oh, what's a clever little take I could have on this? What's something that I will say that people will think is smart? It's actually going, how are people feeling about this? You know, when with the contact tracing, do people feel deep down that they're embarrassed about what they've done in their life or what they haven't done? And I think using that as the basis of your writing, yeah, helps it. And then you can go from there and take it, you know, to absurd places or situate that it's somewhere else, like in medieval times or whatever. But to having that as the basis, how people are feeling about it is sort of been my philosophy on that.
It's there used to be this idea about the ABC, like an unspoken agreement that commercial networks would almost leave the ABC alone, because the way that it would work is the ABC would train journalists, you know, put the time into them, teaching them all their skills, and then eventually they get poached and they go off and, like, you know, work on 60 Minutes or whatever, right?
Yeah,
that was fine. It was fine for both, because, like, it was good that those journalists moved on, so there was space within the organisation for new people to come through and be trained, and it was good for the commercial networks because they didn't have to put that sort of time into development in a commercial landscape where sometimes you can't just keep supporting something. I mean, Tonight at the ABC is always the one that I come back to. That show should just be on still now in whatever format, because the amount of young writers and performers and whatever it just gave training to of making that style of show, the investment in that right now will lead to a myriad of other shows that all those people write on and make and executive produce and shoot. And, like, it's just an investment in all the future creativity of the people that you have on board, who you give the time and resources to, you know, make something. And it feels to me that's what the feed is doing at SBS at the moment. The amount of, like, talented people who are going through there and creating there, and, like, obviously learning skills they're going to take to other places is I feel like I'm a bit late to the party on this. I'm sure there are most people are listening to this are just like, yeah, duh, we've known for ages. But, like, there is kind of something about letting you learn how to do something, not in the, like, the harshest glare of, like, Broadway.
Exactly. And I think it's a real tragedy that there aren't these sort of, you know, that's a buzzword, but, like, these talent incubator things that used to be around, like, even like ABC and, you know, is forced to be really risk averse because of, you know, the small amount of money they have to play with. And if you look at all the great comedy that's come out of Australia, it's people who were given a chance when they weren't that good, when they were, like, in their early 20s and just mucking around and, you know, just... Yeah, I feel like that it's going to be bad in the long term for Australian TV shows. People are going to look back in 10 years and be like, oh, where's all those great shows that were coming out? And it's because, you know, people weren't given a chance to, you know, flex their muscles and see what works. And, you know, we try and bring in new talent on little content series we make on the feed. But, yeah, the feed is not a comedy show. It doesn't stand alone. There's only so much that that we can do. And, yeah, so...
So comedy adjacent is a good, like, place because you, as you said last year, kept your job, whereas a lot of people that you would know, I'm sure, like, friends of yours, like, you know, from live comedy and that sort of world, who suddenly did not, weren't able to do their job at all. Like, you know, were literally without, you know, even the possibility of them doing the thing that they love that gives their life meaning. Mm. How did you observe, like, what do you think the effect of last year will be on, you know, sort of that generation of creativity? Will it come out stronger than ever? Is there going to be people who don't come back to it? Like, what are your observations?
I mean, I experienced it firsthand because my husband is an actor, and it was last year, there was just nothing going on, and that was really hard for him to go through. You know, I thought, I suppose I was quite worried when I saw, like, people, especially who do live stand-up and stuff, they're doing that 4 or 5 nights a week, suddenly that's taken away from them. But, you know, and I thought, oh, God, it's going to be so bad for the scene and stuff. But going to the Melbourne Comedy Festival this year was so exciting just to see people do amazing work. And I think having, you know, for some people being forced to sort of take that time off and have some reflection and, you know, not feeling like they have to just keep churning out stuff. And I think that in some ways been really good for comedy, or it's, you know, made people sort of realise, oh, I don't actually miss this. Or people go, no, this is me, this is part of my life, I really need it.
Well, it's what you said about before about the sketches. It was good to learn how to do them every day, but when you don't have to do them every day, they become better.
Yeah.
And I think that that was hopefully a lesson that was learnt from, you know, the Australian comedy scene, which is, it's good probably for a while to do a show every year at the festival and get your, like, legs up and those sort of things, but you don't have to do that.
Exactly.
Like, it doesn't, it's maybe not the wrong choice. Maybe it is absolutely the right choice for you to make, but you don't have to do that. Maybe you can think about it for another year and it'll be even better.
That's right, yeah. I think it, you know, it's very difficult for a lot of people, but I think having that break and just being able to sort of recalibrate your mental health a bit was possibly a good outcome. And I think it was good this year that audiences were forced to support local acts as well. That was really exciting to see people say that, oh, their crowds are amazing, and everyone realizing that we, you know, we can put together a whole comedy gala with just Australian acts. So
two comedy galas, they do two of them, by the way. There's like, there's 40 acts or something on there, and and there were plenty of good people who missed out or didn't do it. So,
exactly.
No, I agree. I mean, the only thing that I would say about, you know, Australian audiences aren't forced to go and see them. They choose to go and see them. What normally happens is Australian audiences are forced to go and see international acts because the festival invites out international acts. I'm not saying they shouldn't come out of their own volition in the same way as we would go to Edinburgh or those sort of places. That's the more the merrier. It makes it a richer palette of comedy. But they literally work within a system where normally the festival that puts it on imports 20 international acts, puts them in all the best venues and all the best time slots and makes sure they're reviewed properly. And that just means it's not those acts' fault. It just means by the nature of this limited space in newspapers, this limited space in venues, etc., that the Australian acts don't just get that Broadway, you know, kind of exposure to the audience. They did this year, and they proved that they were the equal of anyone who could be imported to the festival.
Yeah, for sure.
Written and authorised by Will Anderson on the behalf of the Let's Build a Wall and Stop the Internationals.
Yeah, that's right. We're a protectionist comedian now.
Not protectionist. I'm happy for people to compete on the free market. Daniel Sloss came out of his own accord, sold the most tickets. That is fine and dandy. We did not need to pay for his plane ticket.
That's right. It's like how famous people get given, like, free clothes and jewellery to wear on red carpets. It's like, they don't need it. They can pay for that themselves. They got heaps of money.
You talked about how more difficult it is perhaps now to make a career in arts and entertainment. Like, when you said that, were you talking about what has happened with COVID? Are you talking about the fact that there are just so many people now competing for positions? Are you talking about the fact that like there is a generation who came before that haven't really moved out of the way yet, so there's not necessarily space. Like, what makes you think that it is a hard time?
I guess I do look back at, I guess, a generation before us, like, you know, the Chaser guys who I've worked with and continue to work with, you know, like Rove, who I've worked with. There's a bunch of people who are sort of at the top of the game now who were given shows when they were in their early 20s. And we, you know, I was making comedy shows when I was, you know, in my early 20s, but no one said, here, have a TV show. You know, only I'm in my mid-30s now, and it feels like I'm still an up-and-comer in a way. And I just feel like that's definitely shifted. I think it's just a different commercial and economic situation. I do sort of feel like I've come by it as the golden era of broadcast television is waning. I was very like, I mean,
yeah, even that is extremely generous. Broadcast television would be pleased to hear that you think it's in such a healthy state that waning could be a description. It's fucking like that Monty Python sketch. The bird is fucking dead. It is a dead parrot. It is deceased. We are just pretending it's not dead.
No,
at the
it's
moment.
Just got a little cough. It's fine. yeah. But, you know, that also means, you know, that I'm very excited about what people are doing under their own steam. You know, figuring out what live streaming and Twitch is like we do that with our Dragon Friends show, and that's such an eye opener. Like in the middle of COVID, we were doing Twitch streams with 800 people watching live, and it was just you just feel like, oh, I'm just going to go to my Twitch stream and, you know, sit down in your trackies to do it. But if you imagine all those people sitting in a theater, that's crazy, you know. Or so, you know, I think there's some people doing some really interesting creative stuff in that space, and, you know, for extremely niche audiences, and which is nice because they're so free from what broadcast television is by definition, you know, which is having to appeal to as many people as possible. You can just find your little pocket of weirdos all around the world and make stuff for them if you want to.
Yeah, and that's a brilliant and beautiful thing. And, like, you know, as someone who makes a whole bunch of things that are variously successful, a thing that used to really bother me, but much like that everybody in the room needing to laugh at the joke versus the joke for one person, sometimes you're like, you know, we do this like dumb little like AFL football podcast, which really we don't really talk about AFL football much at all. It's just ridiculous, like, and it has such a hardcore loyal audience, and it's almost the audience that I am most proud of, because it's such a dumb niche thing. Like, it's not even, like, it's not for, if you don't like football, you don't think you'd like it. And if you do like football, you probably wouldn't like it either. Like, it's such a, but the people who do like it, I'm like, yeah, I've found our tribe here. It's a really nice thing.
Little cracks in the Venn diagram there.
Yeah, it's good that all these things exist. However, there is also something really beautiful about the idea of everybody sitting down Wednesday at 8 o'clock and they're going to watch Win the Week. You know,
there
is a sense of, because even if we're watching the same clips on YouTube or, like, you know, the same Twitch, maybe Twitch a bit different, like you're going live, it is a little communal experience. But, like, if we're all consuming these things at different times and at different moments, it still is different to the idea of us all sitting down and watching something together.
Yeah, yeah. And I love that idea, and I love that we can bring people onto the show in front of the camera who we don't normally get to see on TV, and, you know, give them their moment in the sun. And you know, we're trying really hard to get such a big cross section of Australia. So I hope that'll help. I, you know, it's kind of, you know, the same principle of why Gogglebox has gone gangbusters, because we didn't get to see these amazing, hilarious people on TV before, and suddenly they're there, and everyone's in love with them. So that's what I hope that we can do. And, you know, something about it being so time sensitive as well, like all the questions are from the news of the week. Like, we've really shot ourselves in the foot in terms of getting repeats, because you know, in 5 days it's not going to be relevant anymore. But
I don't know about that. I catch a lot of Paul McDermott's Think Tank, and heaps of the questions on that were very topical. Like, there's other ones that aren't, but there's like heaps that are. And mm-hmm. you're just like, oh, who cares? Like, it's good. I like the ones that aren't as topical because you feel like that most of the information has finally sunk in. So if during the week I wouldn't have known the answer to that question, but it's been like, it's like playing like a, you know, a Trivial Pursuit from 2012. You're like, yeah, oh, okay, yeah, I get the, like, all the important stuff from 2012 I know now.
Yeah, I'm a genius. I know all these answers. Yeah.
Okay, so you got this new show starting, but, you know, you're also doing a whole bunch of things, including, you know, being the mother of a two-year-old. And obviously, you know, doing the maths correctly, the majority of, like, the life of you having a baby has also been during a global pandemic. So, like, what was that experience like?
Well, I think I was lucky that he wasn't old enough to ask questions, or he didn't really know what was going on. I feel really sorry.
For him, life was pretty similar anyway, right?
Yeah, like, you know,
not a lot of changes than what it would have been.
Yeah, it was a bit pissy that he couldn't go to a playground for a while. But, you know, especially here in Sydney, we were so lucky and we really got off lightly compared to the rest of the world and the rest of the country even. Yeah, you know, in a way it was nice. We went and had more bushwalks and things like that, like things that we were allowed to do. It's funny though, like, yeah, he was playing with an aeroplane the other day and all the places he was saying he was going were all very local. You know, where's the aeroplane flying? And he said, Broken Hill. I was like, it's pandemic children have no idea of the world outside of their own state.
Oh man, that's funny. Like, were you a traveler before this happened? Were you the sort of person who would, like, you know, pack up your suitcase and get on a plane and go and explore the world?
Yeah, I did spend all my money just going to Melbourne for the comedy festival for quite a few years, being like, oh, how come everyone else my age gets to travel around the world? Realizing I've pissed it all away at the Hi-Fi Bar. But yeah, we went to Italy for a friend's wedding before the, you know, in June last, the year before last, and that feels just crazy that we could have done that. Yeah, so we did a bit of traveling, some of it was for work and stuff like that, but yeah, it's very strange now. It feels like everything's coming back to Australia now, you know, with stuff that's being shot here. And before that, you know, we were considering, oh, do we need to move to LA or London or something like that, and now it sort of feels like we don't have to, or this, yeah, that appeal sort of isn't there anymore.
I mean, you would suggest in a way that it's in Australia's interest that the global pandemic happened, at least for, you know, like Hollywood coming to Australia. You can't look at it any other way. It's part of the reason it came down here. Chris Hemsworth came home, Matt Damon decided to come over, and then suddenly everybody's in Australia. Right?
Your Sydney lab leak theory, Will.
Well, all I'm just saying is it's in our best interest in a lot of ways. For the Australia, maybe the entire Wuhan, like, you know, lab thing is actually the Australian Film Industry the Institute just rolling the dice one last time, just going, this is it.
Well, there was that picture of Guy Sebastian in Wuhan, remember, just before the pandemic. So maybe they sent him over with a few vials. Who knows?
Did it make you change the way you thought about life at all? Like, the pandemic was, as in, like, did it make you reassess, you know, what life was about, or, like, you know, particular meanings in life, or just the way that you were living your life? I mean, clearly you were going through a pretty big life change at the time anyway, like, you know, if you're having a kid. But, like, did the global pandemic, like, you know, change your mind on anything?
Yeah, I think it sort of clarified for me that if this, or, you know, working in TV and in comedy, if I had to stop doing it, it'd be okay. In a way, like, oh no, it's not. I just think there's so much more, you know, the world is about to face so many bigger issues right now. And, you know, we had big conversations, like my husband and I, about, you know, whether it was going to be viable to do, especially for both of us being in this industry. I wasn't smart enough to marry someone with a good secure job, like a lawyer or something like that. But yeah, I guess that I guess how I think of it is it's, I feel so lucky to be doing what I'm doing, but if I had to stop, you know, because I needed to do something that was more stable, or I felt like, I don't know, not fulfilled by what I was doing anymore, or that I could do something that was more helpful. Like, I'm not terrified by the idea of not doing this. You know, I kind of...
What's the one thing that you would be glad never to do again about it? Like the one thing that you're just like, definitely this. I would be so glad I never had to do that again.
Just the uncertainty of it, really. Like, just knowing that even if you've recorded something and it's on air, that it could still be taken away from you. Like, it's just such an insane way to live your life, really. Being like, well, this could all go away tomorrow. And I think you sort of, I don't know, I love it and it's all I want to do at the moment. But I guess I have a space in my heart where I'm like, oh yeah, you know, if I had to do something else, and I'm sure I could find meaning in other things as well.
Gave us the opportunity to recognize, to assess what our other options would be and see how comfortable we would be with those other options.
I mean, I don't know what I would do or who would have me, but
that's my major hurdle.
That's right.
I'm fine with stepping away from the job that I have. The idea that I could replace it with anything is where this entire plan comes apart.
Yeah, the only time when I was confident about that was when I saw that milkshake video and I was like, what am I doing? You know, that terrible government ad. I'm like, slaving away, trying to get TV shows up. Like, we could just, you know, in my head, I was like, I could have made that terrible ad for a lot more money than what I'm making now.
So I'm interested in,
hate myself.
Yeah, because I mean, clearly you've made other choices. You could do that, and you've made other choices. Do you worry about getting in trouble, like transgressing? Like, I mean, you know, sketch comedy, like government funded sketch comedy, like. Those are sort of current affairs, areas where people are constantly, you know, trying to get angry or upset about something somebody said or, you know, some bit. I remember doing a deep dive to see if I could find some controversies that you'd been involved in, because I assumed there was going to be one. I'm pretty sure I remember, like, I saw some sketch about a swastika on somebody's head.
Yeah, that was the one.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, that's probably the closest we've gotten. There was one we did when I was working on The Roast back in 2014, which the government wasn't happy about. Some awful cartoon we did. I can't even remember what it was. It wasn't very flattering to Tony Abbott or something. But, oh, yeah, I mean, everyone lives in constant fear of the day your cancellation comes for you, right? Like, I think, when it's going to happen eventually. And I just go, well, I had a good run. See ya. Sorry about all that.
Yeah, I know. There is a part of me that would love to go back to me 10 years ago and go, hey, there's going to be this like online platform called Twitter, right? And they'll have like the top trending topics. Like, you know, so the things that are being talked about most in the world, like on that day, they'll be the trending topics. And you might be on those trending topics. You'd be like, oh, that's great. Like, it's amazing that like I've done something so good that people, they'll be like, no, you're either dead or you've been cancelled. Yeah, they are the only two reasons that you are
you
ever
don't want anyone talking
Twitter.
About you on Twitter.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, the day you log on and you see your name there, you just like walk away from the computer, throw my phone in the river, fake identity, go.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess I did get sued for defamation by Alan Jones, which I probably can't talk about that much, but that felt a lot like getting in trouble. That was quite scary. But also, you know, I think as long as you're pissing off the people you want to piss off, you're sort of, that's part of doing your job.
And so how do you choose who those people are? Like, I mean, there must, I don't mean individually, but I mean, there must be some sort
of list.
Philosophy of what makes somebody an appropriate target for satire and comedy.
Yeah. And my mum actually said this to me. I had done a few sort of monologues about Scott Morrison. She said, why do you ever say anything nice about him? I was like, what? That's not, what's that? That's nothing. This is, but yeah, you know, I think it's always, looking out for people who are being hypocritical, or people who are, you know, abusing power. I guess it's those sort of things that the things that spark that outrage in you.
And then do you guard, like, in a personal sense, like, your own values to align with that? Like, you know, are you aware of times where you're being hypocritical, or you might be, like, abusing some power that you have?
I'm such a hypocrite. When there's so many things, I'm like, oh, like, I philosophically agree that humans probably shouldn't eat meat, and yet I find it delicious. That's only. I guess it's also just, you know, what can you do in your position, and trying not to sort of rest on your laurels too much, and recognize that, you know, the same way that people helped you get to where you are today, how you can do that for other people. And looking out for new talent and stuff like that, like, that's really important to me, and I, you know, try and get out and see stuff, and not just rely on the people around you that you see, that you go, oh yeah, we could do that together. I think that's important, but I, you know, also think I can do it more than what I do, so
What would you look for when you're looking, like, for new talent? Like, is there a particular quality, is there particularly, like, is it, you know, are you looking for someone who you can see is a good writer, or is a natural performer, or is there just an energy that they give off, or is there, like, something about them that makes them individual? Like, I mean, what is it that would initially catch your eye when you're, like, identifying new talent?
I guess it's just people who are, you know, have original ideas and, you know, have a way of looking at the world that you haven't seen much before. I think, you know, diversity in TV is something that's obviously very important to me, and seeing people from different types of backgrounds and making sure they're represented. But I think, yeah, in terms of specific things, especially, I guess, for, you know, people who we think can work on shows, is people who are self-motivated and driven to sort of make their own stuff. I think that's really important. People who can work, who, you know, you feel like can work in a team as well, because I think there's a big gap between being able to write and perform stand-up, which is just for yourself, and being able to work collaboratively. It's a completely different skill.
Tell me, I ask people if they have a life philosophy. So do you have, like, a life philosophy of any kind?
I think in terms of, you know, what I do, I do try and sort of not make sure I'm not thinking about myself as the centre of it all. I think sort of decentering yourself and saying, like, okay, even if I'm the host of this show, thinking about what the audience experience is like and what the experience is for everyone else, I think that's a way of managing sort of anxiety and stuff like that, but also realizing that it's not about you, and it really is just about you, and there's a lot of people working hard to help make a project. Yeah, I think that's something that's always been important to me. Like, when I was working in the news, and I had to do my first bulletin, which was, like, at midnight and 90 seconds, but still, just thinking, like, you've got to get out of your own head. Don't think about how you're looking or how you're sounding. Like, what's important is that the people at home get the information that you're giving them. And so I feel like that's a philosophy that was, you know, probably the first time I was on TV. I feel like I've tried to use that in whatever I do. Just as a way to get out of your own head, and making sure that, because that's when you make mistakes, and that's when you stumble. And I suppose my philosophy is just thinking about the experience for the audience and for the people you're working with. And I think that comes from an improv background as well. It's not about you and your ideas and getting them out. It's about being there for your scene partner and I think there's a lot about improv that has informed what I do.
It's interesting, isn't it? Like there was a period of time in Australia, and I'm not really sure why, because like theatre sports happened, and you know, launched like Andrew Denton and you know Sean McAuliffe and like Glenn Robbins on TV, and like improvising is great skills for comedians to have. And then of course it evolved past what theatre sports is. Like some people I think still think that improv is like theatre sports, but it is a whole evolved art form and quite, you know, in its own right. Well, it's a thing in its own right now that, exists in its own right, has fans of its own, has shapes and art forms and subcultures and sub-genres within it. That like even the idea of saying, I like improv, are you talking about the idea, do you like short form improv, do you like gameplay, do you like long form improv, like are we talking about like purely comedy stuff, like is it one person, is it a series of people, like you know, is it a stand-up comedian doing an improvised like stand-up show, like there are so many things now that could be under the umbrella of like improv, but you're talking about that idea of like you know doing improvised scenes and stories with like people on stage having to listen to what else is going on.
That's right, yeah. And you know, a lot of the shows that I do, it's sort of an ensemble thing, so there's like eight of you and any of you can jump on at any stage in any combination, and it's, you know, so much of it is just about trusting that person. Someone brings you up, no, they've got an idea and they want to do something with you, and you just have to be there and ready to do their idea and add what you can and execute it as much as possible, and you know, knowing when to edit, like knowing when your time's up and you should get out of there. Like I think that's a good skill to have. Trying not to let things peter out.
Speaking of not letting things peter out, not that they would, but I was going to do a better segue than that about the finality of scenes and knowing when to get out, but we got to peter out, so I had to go there. There are some more standard questions that I need to ask, and I'm aware that we're running out of time. So what do you think happens at the end? What do you think happens when we die?
Nothing. I think when we die, we just become part of the earth again. I don't really have a problem with that. I think that's just the way it is. It doesn't particularly scare me. I actually had an incident in a lift today where there was a huge bang. I was in the lift with Craig after we'd gone and shot something and two other guys. There was a huge bang and we looked at each other and there was just that moment where we were like, oh, we're all going to die. And they were just fixing something in the lift and we were fine. But it was funny where, you know, it's one of those funny reminders where you go, oh, yeah, that's gonna come for me one day.
Sometimes that.
And I didn't
too.
Think it was in a going to be in a lift with Craig Rucastle, but here we are.
No, I was like, I nearly died recently, just in a similar
really?
Sort of situation. I'm fine. Spoilers, I'm fine. I'm here. But I was driving home on a back road near my house, and a really huge branch fell like on my car, and like 10 centimeters more one way, and like I would have. At very least, I would have driven off the side of the road. It was like it's on a big hill, windy road, like, you know, whole thing. So, yeah, absolutely nasty. But because I was fine, you don't really, like, it's not until everybody keeps going, oh, yeah, you probably almost died. Like, you know, because you didn't and you're fine, like, there's part of your body that's just like, oh, well, you know, I didn't die, so everything's fine.
Yeah.
And then people will keep going, man, you could have died. And then after enough people go, man, you could have died, suddenly your brain is like, hey, maybe we should be thinking about that a little bit more, about how we could have died. And you do realize, oh, fuck, that would have been it.
Like, yeah, that's right.
So many things half done.
It wasn't it, but it could have been. And, you know, and when it does happen, it could just be just like that, like having the most normal day and then it's all over. It's,
I want someone I trust to go through my computer, and I don't mean that in a like a hack stand-up comedy way. I mean that in the way that I actually need my hack stand-up comedy to be erased, and like there's good stuff in there. Like, there's some half-completed ideas. There's a couple of things on the computer that I'm actually really proud of that I would love people to, like, still be able to access or whatever. But
have you got them organized in your folders? Have you got delete not, upon my death? Or
no, but I'm, like, after this, like, branch incident, I'm really feeling like that's what I should be spending some time on, is going through my computer and, like, labeling things clearly what needs to be deleted upon my death. Because it honestly was... Because I've got a few projects on the go at the moment, so there's just a whole bunch of, like, things that have started. Things that maybe could be great, things that maybe I'll just put in the bin, but there's just, like, a lot of, you know, COVID half-started ideas. And I don't want that to be my legacy.
No. A lot of just sketch titles sitting there in Google Drive just waiting to be discovered. Yeah. Have you got someone in mind who you would trust to curate that for you?
I mean, technically, I think for my post-death vanity, because somehow I'm more in, like, more vain post, I think, life than I am during it. But someone who can punch it up a little, to be honest.
Someone who
can, you know, like, just give it maybe like a, you know, Sophie Braham or James Colley, if they could come in and do me one last favour. Be sweet.
This is a really different meaning to the term ghostwriter.
Right. Do you care about your legacy? Is it, like, would it matter to you if, like, you know, if you, I don't mean obviously it'd matter if you died tomorrow, but would it matter if someone went through your notes file and your half ideas on your computer?
I think they wouldn't do anything with them unless they really had it in for me. Imagine just staging a comedy show, being like, remember that chick who died? Let's check out all those shit.
He's a dead chick's drafts.
Yeah.
At the Melbourne Comedy Festival.
Oh, you know it'd get 5 stars. I'd see none of it.
Yeah. Sell very well. You'd win the award.
I know.
Posthumously. have you ever had any religion or, like, overarching spirituality in your life? Or have you just always been of the sense that, you know, you were and you weren't, and then you were and then you won't be?
I went to a Christian school, and so it, you know, definitely grappled with those things when I was younger. But both my parents are atheists, and, you know, they were always willing to chat about stuff, but you know they had their opinions and there was no changing it for them. And that used to terrify me when I was a child, just thinking that there could be a moment where I could get to go to heaven and they couldn't. Like, I hated that idea. And I think the more you realize that, you know, religion in that sense is much more metaphorical and about, you know, that's not about two different places, it's just about a different state of being, then it's sort of easier to grapple with and just come up with your own conclusions. And, you know, there's a lot about the institution that I disagree with and, you know, doesn't appeal to me at all.
If you could have any skill in the world, you don't have to do your 10,000 hours. You just wake up one day and you are able to perform this skill, however you want to interpret that. What would you love to be able to do?
I would love to be able to understand the stock market. That is just such a big gap in my knowledge. But anything about the economy, if someone could just, you know, put that chip into my brain and I could understand it, because I really do feel like, you know, I'm missing out.
I think here's what I would say. Maybe you're missing out financially, but essentially what you're saying is, I wish I could get in on this hustle, because like, you can't understand it. People make, you know, millions and billions of dollars pretending that they understand it, but they also lose millions and billions of dollars for the exact same reason. It is an entire fucking absolute, like, shady con. And like, basically what you're saying is, I'd like to get in on this shady con.
Yeah, I'd like the confidence to get away with the con.
If there was something about your own life or personality that you could just, it doesn't have to be a big thing, it could be like a big or small thing, it could be an annoying habit that you have, but just something that you could erase from your, like, life or personality or, you know, whatever, what would that be?
I wish that I could erase. Probably just all the time I've just spent fucking around on my phone. I just like... I just like those hours back. Probably what, I could have used that time to learn what the stock market is.
Yeah, rich. But then you'd be constantly fucking around on your phone because there's nothing that's going to make you fuck around on your phone more than being addicted to the stock market. Like, we check back in, you've taken your ABC win the week money, you've invested in some sort of fucking crypto. You're like the Scott Pape of the ABC.
Trying to get everyone in on it, on my new scam. Yeah.
Okay, a couple more questions and then we are done. On my desk, I have a little lump of metal, and inscribed in it is as close as I get to an inspirational saying. It says, "What would you attempt if you knew you could not fail?" Right. So what it means to me is it's just meant to remind me to, like, just to attempt the thing that I want to attempt and not worry too much about, like, whether it's going to be successful or whether it's going to be a failure or whether those are things you can even measure in the way that, you know, they will be measured. Just to, like, you know, attempt the thing that you would want it to be if success was already guaranteed. Because there are some people, I guess, who just see success as a goal in itself. Like, you know, that's kind of what I think what happened in America is America bought into the idea that it doesn't really matter why you're successful. It just matters that you are successful. But in this question, what I'm really asking is, you're guaranteed already that the thing you're about to say succeeds. So what is it? What is the thing that you want to do that is really successful?
I mean, I'd love to be able to dive from a really high diving board.
Oh yeah.
The thing that's stopping me from that is almost knowing that I will fail.
Like, would you dive off?
If I knew that I was going to do a perfect landing, and that's what you're promising me, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. This is a good answer to this question. Like, I really like this because. Okay. Have you ever been fascinated by jumping off like a cliff into an ocean, like that sort of diving? You know, that sort of, like, you know, you see it in, like, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio movies and, young people things where like I always love dig the idea of that so much. Like, I'd be like, I would totally be into that. But there is another part of my brain that's like, that is a really stupid thing to do.
Yeah.
And you would most definitely kill yourself. But if I were guaranteed that that is not the case, I would absolutely love to do something like that. So I dig this answer.
I think that a big part, I'm so risk averse in a lot of my life, and I have been in opportunities where I could have taken a big dive off a cliff and seen other people do it, and have chosen not to because I don't want to, like, if I was, you know, younger, I would be worried about looking stupid and getting big wedgie or something. And now I'm older, it's more just smashing myself on some very hard water. But there's something about the gracefulness of it and being the type of person who can do that is very appealing to me.
I agree. It's a good answer.
Perfect landing.
No one's ever gone there before, and I'm not sure that anyone will again, but I think it is an excellent answer to that question. One more and we're done. Firstly, Win the Week is the name of the show. It is on 8 o'clock Wednesday nights on ABC, or you can catch it on ABC iView, which is the ABC streaming service. It is free. You can go there. You know, you might not be listening to this, you know, before the show comes out, but you can go there and catch up with previous episodes if you're listening to this episode, you know, a few eps in. So that's the plug. Also, of course, the feed on SBS and all the incredible stuff you can catch. The comedy sketches, of course, online. Yeah, they share most of those around as well if you're not watching the entire show. But it's on SBS On Demand, which is SBS's streaming service. Any other plugs? Is there anything else you would like to plug?
Oh, if you like Dungeons & Dragons, you can listen to Dragon Friends. There's 6 seasons for you to catch up on.
What if you don't like Dungeons & Dragons? Like, if I didn't... Like, how would it be for me? Who knows? Well... I'm going to reframe that because I'm not saying I don't like Dungeons & Dragons. I have no idea whether I like Dungeons & Dragons because I've never dipped my toe in to know if it's something that I would like. Do you think that I would like the podcast?
Are you scared to know that about yourself, that you might like it?
Yeah, I'd be fine with it. I mean, now it'd be fine, although Would I be able to find people to play with? Like, if you suddenly get into Dungeons & Dragons at 47, are you a little late to the party? Are you the stranger danger who suddenly goes, oh, you guys want to play Dungeons & Dragons? No, I just got into it now.
I think you could get into it because I'm still very ignorant about it. I don't play it outside of doing this show. It's comedians who don't really know what they're doing playing it. So if you're ever, D&D curious, it's a good one to start with.
Final question. I have a time machine. It is a round trip to any point in history or any point in the future. You can visit your own life, you can affect your own life, but you don't have to. You can just go somewhere and see it or experience it or, you know, whatever you want to do, basically. All I require is the fictional machine back at the end of the journey.
Uh-huh. All right, fine. I'm very interested in what the future's going to look like. I don't think the past has much for me. I think I'd die pretty quick. I don't have the survival skills, but there's never been a better time to be a woman of colour, so I think I'd stay here. But I reckon I'm so curious to just go 300 years into the future. Let's see if there's anything left. Let's see if there's any grim warnings I can bring back to us back here at home.
I love your sense of, like, optimism that you couldn't go back in time because it'd be too dangerous. But 300 years in the future, I'm sure that'll just be perfectly fine. Like, 20 years ago, there was no internet. Like, what's it going to happen in 300 years?
Well, you know, I'd like to, you know who's who's controlling the planet and ingratiate myself to them now. I'll start being nicer to the robot shop assistants at Woolies.
Why is Alex just talking to the supermarket checkout for so long? She's making real small chat with her. Long day? what are you doing?
Yeah, take a load off. Come and have a seat.
You know what? I'll add this up. You know, this is not for you today. Thank you so much for doing this. This was a great pleasure.
Thanks, Will.